We're going to be looking at a wider section of the Gospel of Mark, talking about how Jesus has the ability to open up eyes and ears, I think is going to be one of the main ideas coming through this section. Donovan Newman is going to open us up in a word of prayer in just a moment, but just as a reminder, as we're looking at the Gospel of Mark, the overall picture of the book is that Jesus is the king, but he's a servant king. He's not a king who uses his authority so that people will serve him and he can line his pockets and all of that sort of thing. He's actually a public servant, like in the real sense of the term, but he's healing people at their deepest needs. And throughout the Gospel of Mark, we've seen different pictures of Jesus being the king. John is rolling out the red carpet. Jesus is having authority over the demons. The word Christ has been associated with him, which means that he's the anointed one. And in the Old Testament, the most common use for that is referring to kings. And so Jesus is pictured as the king who, ironically, in chapters 9 through 16, has to go to the cross. And that's where we see his sacrificial service for us. So this morning we're almost through this section here where we emphasize the public ministry that he did. And then we're going to start seeing him talking about his sacrifice beginning on Wednesday. So any comments or questions about that before we get into the class for this morning? All right, Donovan, do you want to start us out with a word of prayer? All right, I'll say one other thing about this chart really quick, that chapters 1 through 10, Jesus is mainly going to be in Galilee and Judea, but in this text that we're looking at this morning, there's going to be three stories, one after another, where Jesus is in Gentile regions. So there is an exception to that. But beginning in chapter 11, that's when Jesus is eventually going to get to Jerusalem. So you can remember the book geographically, you can remember it thematically with these different, or even with timetables here. I hope that chart just helps you understand Mark from a couple different angles. But this morning, here's the outline of what we're looking at. So in Mark 6:53 through 7:23, you have Jesus having this clash with the Pharisees over the traditions versus Scripture. And you'll see why in just a moment, why I include the end of chapter 6 and not just the beginning of chapter 7. I think there's a reason for that. And then Jesus is going to heal some Gentiles in the middle section, and then chapter 8, the first 26 verses, at least the way that I see it, Jesus is dealing with spiritual blindness and how that can be solved. And so that's where we're going this morning. Just a couple other introductory things about what we're looking at this morning. There's two stories in this section that are unique to Mark's gospel. The first one is there's a man who's deaf and he's mute. And so Jesus is going to heal him. The Gospel of Matthew sort of brings it up, but it doesn't give any detail to it, and it's just kind of in passing as a summary that Jesus healed a lot of people. And so that's more unique to Mark. And then also there's going to be this man that is blind, and Jesus is going to heal him in two steps. So both of those stories you're not going to see in other Gospels. But throughout the section that we're looking at this morning, I am especially impressed with the fact that Jesus has different approaches for different people. There's going to be some people that he's going to be more stern with. There's going to be some people that he's more patient with. There's going to be people that he questions to help them understand things in a deeper way. But I think we need to be impressed with the fact that Jesus was not a one-size-fits-all kind of person. There are some people who might boast in being the blunt kind of person, and they're just always going to be that way, when maybe you need to adjust yourself to certain kinds of people. And then there's other people that are really going to be soft and gentle all the time, when sometimes you actually have to question people pretty strongly. And so we're going to see Jesus adapting himself to the different people that he's interacting with in this section. And I think that's an important lesson to take away from what we're going to be looking at. I'm just going to front load the class with that idea. Any comments or questions about that before we start looking at the first section here? All right, I'm going to start out by reading chapter 6, verses 53 through 56, just to introduce this traditions versus scripture debate that happens. So look at Mark chapter 6, verses 53 through 56. When they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. Okay, Jesus just walked on the water. He calms the windstorm, as it were, and they get to the other side of the sea, and they get to this place where there's a marketplace. And people are bringing people on sick beds and everything like that. People are trying to touch, by the way, the fringe of his garment. Anybody have any idea what the fringe of a Jewish male's garment would have on it? The tassels. In Numbers chapter 15, they were supposed to wear special tassels that would help them remember the covenant that they were part of. And it seems like Jesus was wearing that. So he's pictured as a pious, following the scripture kind of man in this text. And then he's going to have a confrontation in chapter 7 with people who think that they're pious and they think that they're following the law, but they're not. So you get that little hint kind of there with Jesus. But notice that in verse 56, where is Jesus performing the healings? Countryside, people are bringing all the people to the marketplace. They're laying the sick in the marketplaces. All right. So notice that in verse 56. Jump down to chapter 7, verse 4. Let me start in verse 3. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the what place? The marketplace. They do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. All right. So you see that in verse 56 of chapter 6, they're healing in the marketplace. That's one of the places that they're doing that. I imagine that the disciples are already in this location. They've bought food, and they're eating the food that they bought in the marketplace, and they haven't done this hand-washing thing that the Pharisees have problems with. So that's why that's kind of some of the connections that I see between the two sections. I think sometimes those summary parts, like at the end of chapter 6, are easily skipped over, when oftentimes they're a perfect lead-in to the next thing that we're about to look at. So I think those are some interesting things to bring out about that. All right, so imagine that the disciples, they've just bought food in the marketplace, and they are not washing their hands. All right, is this an issue of hygiene, or what's the problem with them not washing their hands? Yeah, this is a man-made ritual where the Pharisees, there's different historians have written differently about this, that the Pharisees, after they would be in the marketplace, just in case they accidentally contacted a Gentile, they would want to make sure that everything was clean. So they'd have this special way of like dripping their hands dry by holding them out and washing them with their fists, and there's all kinds of different things. And so they thought that just in case we touched a Gentile, if we did, that means that my uncleanness is going to transfer to the food, and then if it transfers to the food and I eat the food, then I'm really disgusting now because there's part like Gentile germs in me or something like that. They're not thinking in terms of germs, but like the cooties or something. So that's what they're accusing Jesus of doing, that the disciples are not doing it. All right, so notice how Jesus rebukes them. He rebukes them by bringing up Isaiah 29, verse 13, that their worship is in vain. Now, what does it mean for something to be in vain? Yeah. Not of any value. This is a shocking passage because Jesus is saying that people can worship God, show him some kind of honor from the way other people would perceive it, and Jesus can say that it would end up actually being useless and not of any value. All right. How can you do that? How are the Pharisees worshiping God in vain? Right. Teresa said that they were worshiping in vain because they brought in their traditions and not worshiping God with their heart. The traditions were things that they started putting above what God actually said. Now, is there anything inherently wrong with tradition? Is it a tradition that we have Sunday morning Bible class? Is it a tradition that we have Sunday evening worship? Are those fine, those traditions? Okay. What kind of traditions become problematic then? When you want to make it a law and it's not a law, what else? What was that? When you put it above God. And Jesus brings up a really good example of this. He talks about the example of Corban. That the Bible commanded that you honor your father and mother. What's one way that you do that? Well, you do it financially. Back then, they didn't have 401ks, so they had children. And so the kids were supposed to take care of mom and dad. And so the Pharisees, who we know from the Gospel of Luke were lovers of money, they wanted to find some excuse to hold on to their money without having to give it to mom and dad, because that's expensive. So what they did is they developed this tradition called Corban. And Corban meant that everything I own is dedicated to God. It's all God's. And then the question is, well, when does God get it? Well, when I die. That's when he gets it. But in the meantime, I can enjoy it as long as I want, which is really just a way of saying that I get to keep my cake and eat it too, as or whatever. So Jesus is saying, you guys have a fine way. You've really created an art of figuring out how to get loopholes around the Word of God and make your traditions be above them. Now, maybe think of some examples today of man-made ideas that actually replace something that God says in a negative way. So, infant baptism. If you baptize an infant, are there some people that say, therefore, you do not need to be baptized as an adult? And you're taking a man-made idea and putting it above what God actually said in that case. There's some churches that will, like, let's say that Christmas falls on a Friday. And they'll have a really big special service for Christmas on a Friday night. And then they won't have any services on Sunday mornings because they already had their services. So there's different examples of how that could look. But any comments or questions you guys want to say about how the traditions end up becoming more important? All right, in verses 14 through 23, Jesus is going to have this discussion privately with the disciples. Well, he's going to start out with the crowd and then talk privately to the disciples. And look at verse 14. And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him." And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean." All right. Jesus talks about there's nothing from outside that can come in and defile a person. And the text says that it was a parable. And so notice this. This is going to be really important for the next couple stories that we look at. The disciples here do not understand the parable. They don't get it. But what is Jesus saying here? What's his point about things from the outside coming in? Yeah, Jesus is talking in the context about what you eat. What you eat isn't going to make you holier or anything like that. Some people have, by the way, taken this to say, well, I can listen to music or watch movies that have really inappropriate stuff because it's from the outside and it's not going to affect me. Jesus, in the context, is talking about food. And sometimes, unfortunately, Christians will make a big deal about their diet and think that they're more holy if they follow this diet, or they can serve God more effectively if they have this diet or whatever. Ryan? Right. That's right. Yep. And so that's why the parenthetical that Jesus has made all food clean. So notice in the context then, what matters more, clean hearts or clean hands? Jesus is about to, if we were to keep reading, he's going to start talking about the things that defile the people, and he's going to list 13 vices that come out of people's hearts. And he's saying, those are the things that matter the most, and you guys are debating about whether or not your hands are clean, but inwardly you're wicked people. I guess I'll say it like this, that whenever people are focused on man-made traditions and man-made ideas, what's the appeal to that? Well, are people going to come up with man-made ideas that are going to finally get me to get rid of my anger and my covetousness and my idolatry and all, like the hard heart issues that I need to work through? No. Traditions are going to deal with surface issues. Let's debate all day long on whether or not we can have a drinking fountain at the church building. But let's not deal with what's really going on in our hearts. Traditions, when people want to focus on those kinds of things, they don't deal with the deeper things of human beings. Steve? Right, especially when it's man-made tradition. When it's man-made traditions, people come up with traditions because it means that I don't have to analyze who I really am. But it makes me still look like I'm spiritual. So, I think that's part of the motivation for the Pharisees in this context. Anything else you guys want to say about that? Yeah, Ryan? Yes. From what I understand, one of the reasons why the Pharisees came up with this law is Exodus 30 talks about special laws for priests having to wash their hands in a special way in case they were defiled, and then they would be prevented from going into the tabernacle. And so it could be that the Pharisees said, well, if it's good enough for the priests, it's going to be good enough for us. We don't want to fall into the same pitfalls that God was worried about for the priests, even though they're never going into the temple. But maybe personally for a Jew, they might think, well, you know what? I just want to be really careful. I want to wash my hands. And would that be fine for them to do that? I think so. That's a personal kind of choice. But the problem becomes when they start binding it on other people. Here's one of the ways that the Pharisees came up with their laws. They would say, we need to do this because it might lead to this. There's certain religions that will say that nobody in the congregation should have internet because of what people might look up. Okay, if you personally need to cut the internet or get rid of your smartphone or something like that, then you need to do that. But that's not something you can bind on the whole church. That's the way that the Pharisees made their laws. So yes, I think that's a good point. Anything else you guys want to say about that? All right, we're not spending as much time as we could on this because this is recorded in Matthew as well, and I, from my perspective, this is probably a little bit more familiar to us. So I want to emphasize some of the things that are more unique to Mark's gospel. 7:24 through 37, you're going to have two healings, and I think both of them are Gentiles. For sure the first one is a Gentile, but I think there's a reason that these stories are placed together, and it started with the disciples' inability to understand the parable. So remember that as we go through this. Let's start out with the Gentile woman in verses 24 through 30. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. And the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But she answered him, yes, Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this statement you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. All right, Jesus goes up to Tyre and Sidon. Book of Ezekiel especially talks about regions like that, regions that were going to be destroyed, ungodly kind of people. The text emphasizes that she was Syrophoenician. Is that Jew or Gentile? And then it says that she was a Gentile. Is that Jew or Gentile? That's Gentile. She's really Gentile. And so she comes to Jesus when he's trying to be all by himself, and she's begging Jesus for her daughter who has demon possession to be healed. Jesus says something to her that has puzzled a lot of people. He says it's not right to give the bread and throw it to the dogs. It needs to go to the children first. All right. So, if you've talked to any people that are skeptics or atheists or think that the Bible's outdated in any way, here's an obvious example of Jesus being sexist, is what they would say. What does Jesus mean by saying that he's implying that she's a dog? So what does he mean by this? Yeah. Yes, the Gentiles were considered dogs. Right. Okay, so culturally, that is the way that the Gentiles were referred to. Jesus' ministry was for the Jewish people. And so that's maybe one piece of the puzzle here. I thought I saw some other hands, though. Teresa? Right. Yeah, Teresa brought up in Mark 6, 1 through 6, when Jesus was in his hometown, did people believe him? No. But then ironically, you get to this Gentile lady, and he can do more work through her because of her faith. Say that again? He's testing her faith, I think, as well. When he calls her a dog, some people have kind of softened the blow a little bit. He's not the Greek word that he uses to call her a dog is carion or something like that, and it's the house pet terminology. It's like the little dog, not like the scavenger crazy one. this is still mildly offensive, at least to refer to her in that way. So notice what she's doing then. She persists. I think Jesus is testing her faith. She persists and believes that a crumb from the table is enough. She thinks that it just takes a little bit to do what needs to happen. That's how much faith she has. So in Matthew, Jesus is astonished at her faith. So what was just said about him testing her faith, I think that's definitely part of what's happening here. Notice, though, unlike the disciples, Jesus just taught a parable to the disciples. They don't get it. Jesus teaches a parable to this woman, and she lives within the world of the parable and answers from within that world by saying, yeah, but even the dogs get the crumbs. I have to imagine that Jesus would have kind of smiled a little bit and gone, yeah, okay, this is pretty amazing, that this woman thinks a little crumb is going to be enough. This will work. Yeah. Right. Yeah, good. He was just bringing up the idea that it's not just going through the motions, it's actually having the faith that Jesus is looking for. And in this case, when Jesus kind of initially pushes back, and the answer is not yes immediately, and when he even says that there's these other people that I have priority to help right now, because the parable is really dealing with priority. We grew up with so many dogs. And the dogs actually had their own seat at the dinner table. It was really weird. And so they would sometimes get our food, but my mom wouldn't feed them first. The children have the priority. So this is dealing with what comes first. And in Jesus' ministry, what came first? The Jews did. And so when Jesus is saying these things to her, maybe part of what he's saying is, I'm not about to start this giant public ministry to the Gentiles either, so don't get that idea that when I heal you that this is what's about to happen. But I saw a couple of hands that I want to get to. You first, and then you, and then you. Oh, that's good. Yeah, the crumb, she's comparing it to the touching the hem. Like, if I can just touch the hem, if I can just get a crumb. There's people that have similar faith in the context. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. And I will say, too, that when it comes to this woman, in terms of priority, was she, along with all the Gentiles, a dog? Was that the priority? That was the terminology. Okay. If anybody's ever going to come to Jesus, do they have to understand that they're actually worse than a dog? You're a sinner, and God's wrath is against you. This woman is able to accept that she's not the priority right now. And even with that, she doesn't get offended and she doesn't walk away. How many people today get offended when you say, all right, you're a sinner in need of grace, and then they walk away? Here's an example of a woman who does not get offended, but she persists. And I think this text is holding her up as a good example. Were you going to say something? Okay. That's good. Yeah. She's bringing up the idea that when Jesus refers to her as a dog, that's not his personal perspective of her. But that's culturally the terms that people would have used. That's a good point to add into the mix, too. So, all right, let's look at the next story. And as I read this, try to think, what in the world is the connection between these two stories? I don't think that Mark is this kind of stringing together unrelated stories. Think how these stories relate to each other. So I'll go ahead and read 31 to 37. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hands on them. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. All right, let's kind of walk through some of the details of this. There's a giant crowd in Decapolis. When was the last time Jesus was there? Yeah, the man that had the 2,000 demons taken out of him and put into the pigs. I'm not sure how many demons there were. There's 2,000 pigs. But anyways, that man begged Jesus to come with him, and Jesus says, no, go back to your hometown, tell people what the Lord has done for you. Next time Jesus comes there, people are not saying, get away, like they did last time. Instead, they're saying, hey, there's this guy here that needs a healing. And so it seems like that man, his work was successful in where he did, in what he did. But why is Jesus healing this man in this way? He does a few strange things here. He's touching his ears, he's touching his tongue, he spits, he looks up. Why is he doing all this? This is sign language. This guy can't hear. And so try to imagine everything he's doing. Jesus touches his ears, like, this is your problem, you can't hear. And then he touches his tongue, like, you have a problem speaking, right? He looks up, I think, to say that what it's about to happen to you is going to come from heaven. And then he says one word that you could lip read. Ephphatha, or how, you know, however that would have been. But that, you say one word, people can lip read. So Jesus is communicating to this man in a language that makes sense to him. Why is he sighing? Jesus sighs before he does it. Maybe it's because he's seeing how sin has impacted what it's done in this world, and he's getting very personal. He's privately healing this guy. And you see how Jesus thinks about the nature of sin and what it's done to the world. But I think one of the lessons from this, well, let me ask this. Does anybody have any idea how this story flows from the one we just looked at? That's possible, yeah. Yeah, Donovan? Okay, good. So he's dealing with all of them where they're at. Good. What else? Yeah. Right, so he can't understand what Jesus is teaching, and in the context, the disciples, Jesus teaches a parable, do they get it? No. Then Jesus teaches a parable to the Syrophoenician woman, does she get it? So at this point, maybe the disciples would be like, well, man, I wish I could understand. Do you ever struggle with that? Like, there's certain people that you think, man, they just have such a grasp of the Bible. Every time they read something, they just get it. I wish I could be somebody like that. And then what's the next scene? Jesus taking a guy who can't hear and also can't speak, we'll say more about that in a second, and then he can fix that problem. And so I think the idea of this is that if Jesus can open up people's ears, he can help them speak, he can help them understand and comprehend. I took a sign language class. In college these days, everybody has to get a foreign language. And so mine was sign language. And The teacher that I had was actually deaf. And so there was a couple times where she tried to say something out loud, but she was always ashamed to do it. Because she felt like from people who could hear, that from our perspective, she would sound stupid. That was her concern about it. So she didn't want to say anything. Well, how come people who are deaf have a really hard time articulating anything? Because they can't hear. If they've never heard what it sounds like, they're taking a shot in the dark. And so, in like manner, if we can't hear what Jesus is saying, are we able to speak what Jesus has said? No. Are there some people that try to say a lot of stuff about God without listening first? And it sounds like a bunch of garbled mess, is what it sounds like. So here's Jesus able to take people who can't hear, the disciples can't hear right now, but are they supposed to be able to speak when they are sent out to preach and teach? Yes. And he's going to get them to the point where their ears and their tongue have been released. By the way, the word for released in verse 35, that the tongue was released, that's Exodus kind of imagery. When the Israelites were released from bondage, when they were released from Persia and stuff like that. And so there's imagery here about the Exodus being over with as well. All right, anything you guys want to say about these two stories going together? Yeah. I think it's the crowd. Yeah, the question is, who are the people in verse 36 he's telling to not speak about this? I think it's the crowd that had brought him. There's still the secrecy, it's not the right timing, stuff like that at that point. But they do say something interesting, that he's done all things well, which sounds kind of like Genesis 1 when God created everything and it was all good. Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah, and in chapter 8, we're going to see another story that parallels this, actually. But yeah, I think that's the lesson of this. There's a lot of Christians that it can be intimidating being in a church with a lot of good Bible students. And then you think, well, I just don't know if I could ever get it. I don't think I could. And then you've got this story, this woman, the Syrophoenician, she's the good Bible student in the context because she gets it and she answers within it. And then Jesus, the next story, he can do that with anybody. Yeah, Florian?
Yep. Yeah, good. Good. All right. Ryan?
Oh, that's good. I like that. That's a good point. All right. We got like 8 minutes-ish, so I want to try to zip through. I want us to see the big picture of 8, 1 through 26, because this is really beautiful. So let me just go through part of this really quick, and then we're going to slow down at the last part here. So in verses 1 through 10, Jesus is going to feed the 4,000. I'll just say a few things about this. The crowd, there's a crowd of people, and the text begins in verse 1 by saying, "In those days." Which I think means Jesus is still in Gentile territory, though that is a debated issue. I think this is a feeding of a Gentile group. It says in verse 2, Jesus points out that they've been with him for 3 days and they're hungry, and that sets up him feeding them. I think it's cool that they were willing to be hungry for 3 days to listen to him. How many people today would want to do that? And so the crowd is praiseworthy in that way, but here's the miracle. Jesus wants to feed them. The disciples have doubt that he can do it, just like they did in chapter 6. It's like a rerun of the same thing. And in this case, they begin with 7 loaves. In the first, they had 5. In the first, there was 5,000 men that were fed. In this case, there's less people. And so this seems like less of a miracle than the first one, though it's still miraculous, that they have more loaves this time with less people, and they still have the same problems about whether or not he can do it. All right, so they begin with 7 loaves. They end up with 7 large baskets left over. By the way, when Paul was dropped out of a basket in Acts 9, that's the same Greek word, so this is a big basket that can fit somebody the size of Paul. I don't know how big he was. All right, just a couple lessons really quick from the second healing. First thing, I think the gospel is for all people. The bread of life is not just for the Jews, it's also for the Gentiles, and even this Gentile woman in the context got a crumb, and so she's not a Jew, but she got those blessings. Secondly, really quick, Jesus had prepared them for this moment. They had already seen a miracle just like this, and they have the same concerns, but they still fail. Which makes me wonder, what are the things in my life that Jesus has prepared me for that I'm still not getting? You think about what he's done for you in the past, and then when similar circumstances come up again, do we fail, or do we take advantage of how we've been prepared? Now, what's encouraging about the disciples, they don't get it, but is Jesus still being patient with them? Yes. So I think we see that going on with him. All right. Anything you guys want to say quickly about the feeding of the 4,000? Yeah, Raquel? Right, yeah. To say like 5,000 men is just a way of saying it was 5,000 families, I think. So, and we still use terminology like that, but they specifically say gender with the male. But all right, so now, in 11 through 21, the disciples were just blind in their perception of how Jesus is going to help the situation. In this text, we're going to see an expansion of two different kinds of blindness. The Pharisees are going to come, and they're willfully blind. They come up to Jesus, and they want to see a sign from heaven. And right after Jesus does a miracle, they come up and they oppose him, just like Jesus was feeding people or healing people in the marketplace, and then they come from Jerusalem and oppose him. So you have those parallels going on. But what they say they want to see a sign from heaven. What do they mean by that? Jesus just fed 4,000 people. He fed 5,000 people before that. What do they mean by a sign from heaven? Well, maybe what they mean is this. We want to see some kind of like astronomical thing with the stars and stuff, which by the way sort of happened when Jesus was born and the wise men come over. I think they want something up in the skies, not these like feeding things, you know. So instead, they get a sigh from heaven. Jesus sighs, just like he did before, But I think in this case, it's because these people have such hard hearts, there's no amount of evidence that's ever going to make them think that what Jesus is saying and doing is actually from God. So those are the people that are willfully blind. They don't care what Jesus says, they're not interested in it. But by way of contrast, you have the disciples who are blind, but they're willful. They want to learn, but they're still blinded. So the third boat scene in Mark, Jesus is in the boat with them, and he tells them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which was just seen with their ungodly questioning. And then when they hear the word leaven, they go, oh yeah, like, we only have one thing of bread. It's like, if a preacher's using like a sermon illustration, and he talks about like eating food, and then we're just like, oh, what's for lunch today? Like, that's what the disciples were doing. Jesus says, beware of the leaven. He's trying to use food as an illustration for deeper realities. And they're starting to think about the lack of bread that they have. So Jesus rebukes them in the form of seven questions, one after another. And he says, how much bread did we start with in the first feeding? How much did we have left over? How many in the second one, before and after? He's making them recite the works that he's done so that they know that Jesus is going to take care of their needs. He's got it covered. All right, you see the difference. The Pharisees and the disciples, they're both blinded, but the disciples want to learn, but they're just really dull right now. Do you see that? Okay, now you get to this healing that's done in two steps. Jesus comes to this man that's blind, and there's a lot of parallels with what we just saw in 7:31 through 37. Both the guy that was mute and deaf that Jesus healed, they're both brought by their friends. Both the friends begged Jesus. In both cases, Jesus takes the man aside and heals him. And in both cases, Jesus uses his spit as part of the healing process. People back then thought spit had healing qualities, I guess. And maybe that's part of the reason Jesus is doing that. But Jesus takes this guy aside. He's blind, but then he's made to have blurry vision. And then he's given a second touch, and he goes from blurry to clear. Blind to blurry, blurry to clear. Now, Jesus has already done a lot of amazing miracles. Was blindness just too hard for him, and he needed to do it in two steps? No. So why is Jesus healing this man in this way, in this context? Does this parallel the disciples at all? Yeah. Learning is a process. The disciples, they're not completely blind, but are they seeing things in a pretty blurry way? And if Jesus is able to make their vision blurry, that's an indication that the work has already begun and he can take them to have open eyes that can see clearly. All right, let me say it this way. If you've ever been frustrated that you're not seeing the Bible like as clearly as you think you should, and it's hard to grasp, here's a question to ask. Do you understand more right now than you did 20 years ago or 15 years ago? And if the answer to that question is, well, yeah, okay, that means that you're not blind anymore. That's what that means. Which means that Jesus has actually started working on your spiritual sight. So if you're frustrated that you're blurry, you should thank God that you're not blind anymore. And in this story, he can take people who are blurry and give them more perfect vision. Which, by the way, that's what Jesus is going to be doing with the disciples. Throughout these next couple chapters, he's going to repeat his death, burial, and resurrection that's going to happen. They're still not going to fully get it until the book of Acts, but he's taking them and he's giving them the second touch so that they can see things in a clear way. Yeah. That's right. That's a very good point. In the context of everything we're looking at right now, what's one of the causes of spiritual blindness? When you put man-made ideas above what God says. That's what happened in chapter 7. That's why the Pharisees are blinded. And then also, they're just stubborn people as well, and they just don't want to have to submit to God, and that creates blindness. The disciples, well, why are they blind? they're just, it's a process. They're wanting to grow, they're wanting to learn, but their mind is still too much on this world, and Jesus is going to slowly take that away from them. Yeah, Vera? Yes. But you see some break. Yeah. I think whatever it would have done to that man, I think is a parable or an illustration of what Jesus is doing with the disciples. That's why the miracles are things that literally happened, but they have metaphorical value to them. So the liberal scholars will say that they're all metaphors. And maybe ultra-conservative people would say that they're only literal things and there's no greater lessons from them. I think both of them, there's metaphorical lessons, but they're things that really happen. So, all right, anything else you guys want to say about that? Sorry if we went through that really quick, but I was just excited about that, and I hope it didn't go over your head. Yeah. Right, in Mark 9, where there's the guy that says, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. It, in that case, belief becomes a process for him as well. So, all right, anything else? I think we're past time. There it is. All right.